Michigan weather and traffic leader. Broadcasting's News Talk 580. KMJ Fresno.
The news starts now.
I'm Harley Carnes. In Big Sur, California fire spokesman Mark Savage.
We need 100% containment, and then we'll have the fire under control, and then we'll have the fire out. And that's going to take, in this case, could take weeks.
And that's just one fire he's talking about. There are more than 1,000 wildfires in Northern California. CBS's Dave Price.
The operation to fight the wildfires is massive, with more than 18,000 personnel, 1,300 fire engines, 92 helicopters and aircraft, all combating the blazes, which are spread over 550 square miles.
Hundreds more fires burn in Arizona, New Mexico, and Colorado. In the Midwest, the small towns that dot the Mississippi riverbank in Illinois and Missouri.
The water is 2 feet high in my house, and I'm not able to get to it, you know, to be able to find out exactly what's going on with it.
That's Donna McDonald, lives in Foley, Missouri, and she's ready to go or do something different.
If I can get my home raised or have it moved up on a hill where I don't have to be in the flood anymore, I would, you know, I'd like that.
Experts say the river will be receding in coming days. Won't be too soon. There was a moose on the loose in Blackfoot, Idaho. Young bull in search of whatever young bull moose want this time of year that drives them into places they wouldn't usually go. So fish and game people came and tranquilizer darted him and took him to safety in Wolverine Canyon. Oil supplies may be improving in the U.S. after a new deal for oil in Iraq. CBS's Elizabeth Palmer in Baghdad.
They're going to announce they've signed contracts with four companies, BP, Shell, ExxonMobil, and the French company Total. But these contracts were awarded with no bidding process, and that's got a lot of people very upset. In fact, it's confirmed their suspicions that this war was fought all along to guarantee international access to Iraq's oil.
Others say Iraq's oil's been for sale always, and U.S. companies have always been near the front of the line. Republican John McCain met with evangelist Billy Graham and his son Franklin today at their Blue Ridge Mountains retreat. McCain said he didn't ask for their vote or their endorsement, since Reverend Graham rarely ever endorses candidates. He has been a counselor and a confidant of several presidents over the years, however.
I'm Tom Foti. With Barack Obama announcing plans to go abroad and an increasing campaign focus on foreign policy, surrogates for Obama and John McCain were out with the sound bites. One-time Democratic vice presidential candidate, Senator Joseph Lieberman, was channeling an old Hillary Clinton line now transferred to his man.
John McCain is ready to be commander-in-chief on day one.
One-time NATO commander, General Wesley Clark, dismisses the implication that Obama is not.
What Barack Obama understands is that military force may have to be used as a last resort, but it's not the first resort.
Clark and Lieberman were on CBS's Face the Nation. Tom Foti, CBS News, Washington.
Amy Winehouse does more than sing. She has a pretty good right, too. In Glastonbury, the music festival yesterday, she climbed down into the pit after one fan apparently tried to grab her, and she punched him. Sang for about an hour, pre-emphysema symptoms or not. This is CBS News.
And now, another reason to switch to GEICO.
Instead of paying more for car insurance, you'd rather pay less. Call you crazy, but for some strange reason, you like saving money. And guess what? With things like money-saving rates, multi-car discounts, and good driver discounts, GEICO's always looking for ways to lower what you pay for great car insurance. Huh. Guess you can call us crazy, too.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
AutoZone.
Looking for great deals on motor oil?
Get in the zone.
For a limited time at AutoZone, get 5 quarts of Valvoline conventional motor oil and an STP oil filter priced up to $4.19 for just $13.99. Or get 5 quarts of Valvoline MaxLife motor oil and a Bosch oil filter for a low $15.99. And as a bonus, save $2 on any air filter with the purchase of either of these Valvoline specials. Some restrictions apply. See store for details. So get to AutoZone today.
Get in the zone. AutoZone.
What's driving you? Are you an aspiring VIP in a new LE? Headed for higher learning in your hybrid? Toting the marching band in your minivan? Whatever road you take, Speedy Oil Change and Tune-Up can help get you there. With service and repairs that fit your vehicle like it fits you. Visit SpeedyOil.com and tell us what's driving you. With your vehicle information, we'll give you manufacturer service recommendations for your exact mileage. We'll explain the services you need and tell you about the Speedy difference. At SpeedyOil.com, you'll find special savings and offers and a location near you. So whether you're packing your pickup for a picnic or starting a shopping spree in your SUV, Speedy Oil Change and Tune-Up can help get you there.
Speedy, what's driving you?
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and worldwide at KMJ580.com. If you've been following the news, you know that the Bulldog baseball team is in Omaha, Nebraska this week, so that's where I am, and I thought, we can't miss an episode of Hometown Heroes, so let's find an Omaha veteran of World War II with some interesting tales to tell. And I think that we've done that in Sam Basilia, a World War II veteran from here in Omaha. And let's start at the beginning, Sam, before we get to your time in the air over Europe in World War II and your time as a POW. How did it all start? How did you end up in the service? Did you know that you wanted to be in the Air Corps? Did you make the first move, or did Uncle Sam get a hold of you before you could get a hold of him?
Uncle Sam got a hold of me before I can get a hold of him.
You remember when you were drafted?
Yeah, as soon as I turned 18, I got a letter in the mail that I was drafted and had to report to Fort Crook, Omaha, which is now Air Force Base, and that's where I went for my physical.
What did you expect out of all that? You knew what was going on in the world. I imagine you knew that you might see something pretty thick and heavy.
No, I was really happy that I got drafted. I was real happy that I passed the examination and that I was taken. But my mother was very unhappy about it, and I couldn't understand why. That bothered me. When I come home and told her that I passed and I was going into service, she started crying. And it just, for some reason, I couldn't understand that, her reaction, but now I do.
Now, when Pearl Harbor happened, you were obviously too young to get into the service, but was there something in your mind at that point that you thought, maybe at some point I'm going to have to go serve?
Yes, there was. But I, for some reason, I thought that we'd beat the Japs long before they'd go as far as they did, but we weren't prepared at the time, so...
Everybody seems to remember where they were when they heard about Pearl Harbor. Do you remember when you heard what you were doing?
Yes, I was, I think I was with my dad. He was rolling cigarettes. And I was having him roll cigarettes.
Did it hit you right away, the significance of what happened?
Yes, I was very, very angry and disturbed about it.
So eventually, as you said, you get drafted, you end up in the Army Air Corps. Most guys that ended up in the Air Corps wanted to be pilots. Was that something that you thought about, that you dreamed of?
Oh, I'd love to have been a pilot, but I wasn't tall enough. I was only 5'3½". You had to be 5'6". But when I was going through my physical, these submariners kept following me all the way through my physical, and they kept trying to get me to join the submarines. And I kept telling them, I want to see the sun every day. They said, you can see it. And I kept telling them, not through a periscope.
Well, and given the casualties that the silent service took in World War II, that might have saved your life by avoiding those guys, because those guys paid an awful price, and I'm sure you're aware of that.
Yes, they did. They really did pay an awful price, really.
And it wasn't a picnic for you either, but before we get to the intense stuff, did you have a welcome to the service moment when you got to basic training or boot camp, anything like that? Was there something that you said, boy, I thought this was going to be an adventure, but this is pretty hard?
No, I think that everything went along pretty good, but being at my size, when everything, like if we were marching down the road and another group would come the opposite direction, they'd say, get that man out of the hole. And our director, our sergeant, would stop us and stop the other side and say, who wants to take him out of the hole? He always put me on the spot.
Yeah, I guess you stood out in the crowd, huh?
Oh, yes, I did. And there was a couple times when, you know, when they lined you up in the service, they put the tall ones in front and the short ones in the back. And a lot of times, them tall guys would just take big steps to make me run, you know, to keep up with them. So whenever I had the chance of being there, the drill director, why, which occasionally I did, why, those tall guys would stick you know, step off and almost lose me, I just bring them back. So whenever we went anywhere, they had to make two times the trip instead of one. And that, they learned how to take short steps.
I guess so. They learned something from you. So how long did it take before you figured out what you wanted to do in the Air Corps, or maybe what they wanted you to do?
Well, I wanted to be an officer, but I think after, I don't know, 6 or 7 weeks of basic training, there was a need for gunners. And they took our whole class and moved us to Las Vegas, to gunnery school. And that's how we happened to be gunners instead of officers.
Was that something that you found a knack for right away, or did it take a while before you could hit those targets the planes were towing?
Well, no, I went along with the flow, you know. I remember the first time that I flew in a B-17. It was an air-to-ground training class where they put you up in the nose of the plane, and they fly maybe 100 feet above the ground, and then you shoot at a target on the ground. Well, I never been in a plane before, you know, and I felt kind of sick, you know, and so we went on the target, and I emptied the gun just as fast as I could, and I made a beeline for the bomb bay, and whoop, everything came out in the bomb bay, you know. That was my first trip. So that night, about midnight, there come the MPs. And they came and they said, come with us, you know, and I went with them. They took me to that plane. I had to clean the bomb bay.
You had to clean up the mark you'd left on the bomb bay.
Yeah, that mark, yeah. That taught me a lesson, carry a bag with you.
I guess so. Did you ever have to use that bag again, or did that you get that out of your system?
No, it stayed with me. I think, half the times, if we went up, and if we didn't go directly up high enough to get on oxygen, then I would normally, I had a bag, then I went in a bag, you know, and after that I ate a sandwich and I was fine. But if we went directly up where I can get on oxygen, I was fine.
Wasn't all fun and games airplanes during World War II. We're talking to Sam Basile, a Omaha veteran of World War II, and talking to him about his time in the Army Air Corps. He ended up on B-17s as a tail gunner, right?
Waist gunner.
A waist gunner. What was the trick to that? What was the toughest thing, and what maybe made you the most nervous about your duties there?
Well, no, it wasn't the being the gunner. It was the flak, you know, when you, every time we were over Europe, while we got shot at by, the flak was so heavy you can hardly see the plane next door to you. Just the sky was black. And we went right through it all the time.
Well, and you had no choice, right? You had to stay in formation. You had to stay on the course to the target.
And I always hoped, why don't they just go around it? There's no way going around it. No matter where you went, they shot at you.
Could you see all that flak, or were you just feeling it?
I just seen it. I had a big window right at the side of me. I could see it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine there are a few times that you heard a rat-a-tat-tat and checked to see if your legs were still there.
But one time, while the whole shell went through our plane, and right behind me, and it come out the top, but it didn't blow up, which was fine.
I'm sure there's lots of close calls that we're going to be talking about by the time this show is over today. Let me ask you this. When you found out that you were heading overseas, did that produce a different feeling in you? Were you a little antsy, or did you know that things were about to change at that point?
No, it never bothered me when we went over, you know. I went into the service. I was happy to get into service, and I just figured that was part of it, and so I accepted it with no problem.
What about your first mission? What was that like?
That first mission was really something. The first mission I went on, I was the first one of our crew to fly. They put me with an experienced crew. So that morning when I got about 2 o'clock, I got up. Well, the rest of the crew, they were in the barracks, and one guy said, can I have your candy bars? Can I have your hat? Could I have your 45? Could I have this? You know, they had me scared that I wasn't even going to come back before I even left. And I went with the crew. It was June 6th, D-Day. Mm. I went with the crew, and we bombed a factory in Paris. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't really that bad, really. And I come back, and then after that, everybody took a turn, and then we all flew together from there on.
Did you know when you took off for that mission June 6th, did you know everything else that was going on and the magnitude of the Allied effort that day?
No. Nope, I didn't know about the invasion at the time.
When did you find out about that?
Well, when we come back. You know, that was kind of kept a secret until the day they left.
What did that give you a boost when you heard what had happened that day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were all happy we're going to get the countries back to where they belong.
Now, in early missions like that, did you guys have a lot of fighter escorts, some cover, or were you all on your own? Because for you, as a waist gunner especially, if you don't have those fighter escorts, I imagine it makes your job a lot tougher.
Well, we had fighter escort, you know, and but sometimes, you know, they were out chasing fighter planes and or German fighters, and they'd leave us alone.
Apparently, I'm not the only one that wants to talk to Sam Basile here in Omaha this weekend. We'll go ahead and take that opportunity to take our first commercial break. We'll be back with more with Omaha World War II veteran Sam Basile as Hometown Heroes continues on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Tell us about your hometown hero. Email your story by clicking on the Hometown Heroes link at KMJ580.com.
Hi. Hey, you know the three little pigs? I'm the guys who built with straw, sticks, and bricks. Well, I'm the fourth little pig, and I build with steel. Yep, I use Miracle Truss. Hey, that brick place kept the wolf out, but a little earthquake took that sucker right down. Miracle Truss is lighter and stronger than other steel buildings. Talk about hopping and popping. Miracle Truss buildings can take hurricane-force winds. From a small workshop to a large commercial structure, any length, it's the best, which is why it's got the best warranty. Hey, don't wait for the price of steel to climb another 30%. Order now and you can defer delivery. Just go to MiracleTrust.com or call 1-877-51-TRUST. That's 1-877-51-TRUSS. Call now and you'll get the manufacturer's price. I did. And they call the pig who built the brick house smart. Yeah, oink. Call 1-877-51-TRUST now.
Now, Fresno homeowners, this is it. The Fed's rate cuts are over. So if you've been waiting for that perfect rock-bottom rate, make one quick call and lock it in right now. 30-year mortgages have just been hammered, as low as 5.5% with an APR of 5.8. It's incredible, 5.5%. We may never see this again. I'm Hayes Barnard, owner of Paramount Equity. And realize, the Fed's cut rate 7 times in 8 months to help you reduce your monthly payments or jump out of a rising adjustable. Listen, today's the day. There's absolutely zero out-of-pocket expenses, and I'm going to pay for your home to be appraised. So make one simple 5-minute call right now to wipe out your debt and save money for a lifetime. Paramount Equity is committed to saving our neighbors money. Call 456-6000 today. 559-456-6000.
Corporation. 30-year loan, fixed reception.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. Coming to you this week from Omaha, Nebraska. You know the Fresno State Diamond Dogs are playing in the College World Series, and I thought it would be a good chance to visit with a World War II veteran from outside the Central Valley. Sam Basile is from Omaha. He lives in Omaha, but for a while he was the guest of the Gestapo, if you will, as a prisoner of war in Europe during World War II. Before we get to those POW days, Sam, let's get back to your time in the skies over Europe on those B-17s as a waist gunner. What would you describe, obviously you eventually got shot down, that's a pretty close call, but up until that point, you had 32 missions between your first and the time you got shot down. What would you say was your closest call and maybe the one that really got your attention and said, wow, someone was looking out for me today?
Yes, one time we got shot up pretty bad, and we had to make an emergency landing in southern England. They had a huge airfield. I think you can land any direction, and we dropped in there, and somebody had to let a parachute out of the tail to stop us. And when we got out, the plane just kind of looped around a little bit and finally stopped. We all jumped out, and the Limeys were hollering, get that plane off of the field, get that plane off the field. And the pilot hollered out, something you, and take it off yourself. And we walked away. And I think that's the only time that we never made it back to the to our original base.
You must have had a lot of confidence in your pilot.
Oh, yes. I had a lot of confidence in Jesse. He was a good pilot. He had a lot of guts.
What was the camaraderie like among your crew? I imagine most of the missions you had the same exact crew, right?
Well, exactly. Yeah, we all flew together. And then sometime, probably in... Oh, when we were probably halfway through, they figured that they only needed one waist gunner. There was two at a time. There was ten of us on that B-17. There was two in the waist. Of course, the other tail, the waist, the ball turret, the top turret, the nose. And they did away with one of the waist gunners. And the other waist gunner was named by the name of Anderson, Andy Anderson, we called him. He was about 6 foot two. And whenever when the flak got heavy and everything, we just rolled up together in a little ball, you know, hoping that it wouldn't hit us. But then basically why I did, you know, I just tried to do my part like the rest of the crew, and we all got along real well.
Do you remember the first time that you had to empty that gun and fire at the enemy?
I think, well, I fired, but the first time that I emptied the gun was we went on a mission. We dropped supplies to the French Marquis in southern France, like food, clothing, and whatever we dropped. I don't know what it was, but we dropped supplies to him, and we got hit. I was the only waist gunner at that time, and I think an ME-109 come in on my side, and I got on him, and I emptied my gun, which was a bad thing to do, because if someone else would come that side, I just have to throw the barrel at him. But anyway, and then he came, he rolled it to the back, the tail gunner got on him, and then the ball turret got on him, rolled him into the ground. And we picked straws to see who would get credit for it, and the ball turret gunner got the straws. So, but anyway, that was one of the kills that we remember.
But you all had a few hits on him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I hope so. Anyway, I shot in his direction. Whenever I was told, if anybody gets out there and they point their nose towards you, shoot at him. No matter whether it was a German plane or no matter what. So whenever I seen one out there, if he looked like he was coming my way, I let him have it.
How comfortable were your luxurious accommodations in that waist gunner spot on a B-17? Bumpy ride, pretty smooth, spacious?
Really, it wasn't real bumpy or anything. It all depends on the weather sometimes, but actually they flew pretty smooth. The B-17 was a great airplane, really, a smooth rider.
Obviously, there came your 33rd mission when you got shot down. What do you remember about that day? Do you remember what you were thinking when you got up that morning and found out what your mission was?
Well, that morning, we were ready to go. The ball turret gunner didn't want to go. And I asked him why not. He says, I dreamt that his brother was a prisoner of war in Germany. He says, I dreamt that I was talking to my brother over the barbed wire. And I says, Chuck, that don't mean that's just a bad dream. I says, no, I'm not going. So we all talked him into going. And sure enough, he wound up in the same camp with his brother.
Holy cow. We'll explore that a little more here, but let me set the background for our listeners. At the start of the war, the requirement was 25 missions for a bomber crew. You get to come home. Then they said, well, they're making a little further than we thought. We're going to have to up that. We need more out of them. Let's bump it to 30. You get close to 30. Then they say, no, 35. And this was number 33 for you?
Yeah, right. Well, when we when they upped it to 35 from 30, our pilot just says, I'm going to volunteer us for B-29s. That way, when we get done, they'll ship us home. We'll be home before Christmas. And so, of course, we went along with them. This was October, you know, probably the end of September. And so, of course, you know, we went along with them. That'd be great to get home for Christmas. But it, you know, so happened that on our 33rd mission, why we went to Berlin, and it was just, boy, the flak, and in fact, I even think we got attacked over the target. The fighters attacked us over the target. They went through the flag just as well as we did. And then when we got out, actually there was, we always had fighter escort. But the first, we were the last bunch that went over the target. And the first bunch was probably 100 miles away or 50 miles away, and they got attacked by fighters. So all our fighters took off after the German fighters. The German fighters didn't come up as much towards the end of the war because they had a fuel shortage. In fact, one
because of you guys bombing all their oil refineries.
But actually, at one time, they asked the U.S. government to give them fuel so they can deliver the food packages to the prisoners, of course, which they refused to do. Mm-hmm. And but anyway, they left us, and as soon as they left us, then we got hit by a bunch of fighters. They stayed back there, and they really lobbed those 20-millimeter shells at us, clear back about 2,000 yards, you know, out of our range of our guns. And that's what they knocked the both engines on the right out of our plane, and just the plane just dropped like a bullet. In fact, it almost rolled over. Him and the co-pilot had a, he said, we tried everything to keep it from rolling on its back. If it rolled over, we'd have had it. I don't think any of us would have got out. But then they finally leveled it off, and but there was fire in the wing, and so he sent the navigator back and told us that we had to leave. So we couldn't get the waist door open, so we all jumped out of the tail door.
And somewhere along here, you lost your oxygen?
Well, I lost my oxygen as soon as we got hit, I think. And I passed out, and like I think I mentioned before, that the ball turret gunner was out there and pointed to my oxygen supply. And
well, and this is the ball turret gunner who on several missions before had fallen asleep at his post?
Yeah. Whenever we got out of the bomb run, on our the pilot would call up and check, see if anybody got hurt. Why, everybody would answer but the ball turret gunner. And I'd have to crank him up. Jess would call me back, Sam, go see what happened to Chuck. And I'd go back and crank him up, open the door, and poke him on the shoulder. He'd look at me wide-eyed, and I'd say, "You okay? Yeah, okay." And then I'd close it and go back.
So on this time, your 33rd mission, your oxygen gets taken out, you pass out, and the tables were turned. He had to wake you up.
Yeah, he woke me up. He saved my life, probably.
But what do you remember about that? You blacked out, and then when you came to, they're saying, "Get out of here."
Well, I had my bottle on, and I went to the radio room. I thought maybe we could.
When they woke you up, you got some supplemental oxygen, and you were functioning again.
Walk around bottle. We had rock around bottles, and I went to the radio room, and I thought maybe we could do something about the fire, you know. And I couldn't, so I went back into the waist, and I think that's when EJ Barnes, when he went up to the bomb bay, and that's when he came back and said that we were at 17,000 feet. And
which isn't really safe to jump out of an airplane at 17,000 feet.
Well, it'd be safe, but it's a long time hitting the ground, you know. But anyway, we couldn't get the waist door open, so we went out the tail door. I think the tail gunner, I think, went out first, but he sat down. He was holding on to the top of the, he hesitated. It seemed like he didn't want to go, so I kind of shoved him. I remember doing that. And then when I went out, I figured, I'm not going to do that. I'm going head first. So I jumped out head first, and as soon as I jumped, I pulled my cord. You know, I didn't know how high we were. I had no idea. I pulled my cord, and the guy that went behind me said, "My chute opened immediately." He said, "I'm lucky I didn't get caught in the tail," you know. And
I imagine you'd thought about that moment for quite some time. You probably had an idea that that moment might be coming, and you might have to do exactly that.
Well, no, I didn't think we'd ever have to jump. I just figured that we were going to make it, you know.
So were you panicking a little bit at this point? Were you feeling the pressure?
Well, no, I think I was kind of, condition of the plane, I was kind of happy that I had a way out. You know, I had no training as what the chute would do, what it wouldn't do. But they used to always tell, if it don't work, bring it back. It's guaranteed we'll give you another one. And when I jumped, I was coming down backwards. And I looked down, and it looked like I was going to land in the ocean, the sea of water. And I tried to pull on one side of it to see if I could slip and go the other direction, and the chutes start flopping, so I figured that ain't going to work. And then I wanted to turn around, so I took the shrouds, and I turned them, I twisted them and let go, and I just couldn't turn that stupid thing around. And I kept going backwards, 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 and when I hit in a little village. There was their bench, you know, where the people sat. There were probably maybe 8 or 10 houses in this little village, and I missed their park bench by just a couple of feet, and I hit backwards. I rolled like a ball. And when I stopped, there was an old guy there with a rifle pointed at me, hollering, pistol, pistol. And I, no, no, no. I raised my hand, and I said, no. And he lowered the gun. I lowered my hand. He'd bring the gun back up, and I bring my hand back up. And finally, why he let me keep my hands down. And a girl, she must have been about 10 or 11, come up to me, and she says, don't worry, in good English, don't worry, he won't hurt you. You know, and I had a silk scarf that I wore. I took the silk scarf off, and I gave it to her. Mm. And then, of course, they brought the rest of us. I think they brought, I think, 7 of us in. I'm not exactly sure. I think 2 of them got away for a while. The pilot and the top turret gunner got away for a while. The pilot was out for a while. I don't know, a week or... I think the ball turret, or the top turret gunner was out for probably a couple weeks before he got caught.
But you and a good chunk of your crew were taken right away?
Yeah.
How long before it was actually German officers who had control of you? Yeah. These were civilians that turned you over to the...
Yeah. He was in a uniform, though. They called him, I think, the Volkssturm.
Volkssturm, the older civilians, yeah.
You know, it wouldn't take much to put one away. But anyway... And then the Gestapo came, and they were the bad ones. He turned me around quicker than I could shake a stick. My feet were this way, and I went the other way. I mean, he was rough.
Time and time again, I hear POWs tell me that the first thing that was said to them and from someone in uniform was, for you, the war is over. Did they ever say that to you, or is that just a...
No, they never told me. Uh-uh. No.
But it became pretty clear that was the case.
Yeah, it did, really.
Well, we're going to... find out about what that experience was like as a prisoner of war from the fall of 1944 through that brutal winter that you've heard so much about from Battle of the Bulge survivors and through liberation in the spring of 1945. Our guest today, Sam Basile in Omaha, Nebraska, veteran of World War II. We'll talk about his days as a prisoner of war and some recent experience that Sam has had that I hope a lot of World War II veterans in our area and all across the country will get the chance to experience. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Right now, when you switch to Rite Aid, you won't just get your prescription filled. You'll also get a gift card filled with $30. And you could even get your gas tank filled for free. For every prescription you transfer to Rite Aid with a coupon, you'll get an entry into our weekly drawing for a year's worth of free gas, a $2,600 value. Keep your prescription with us, and you'll be re-entered into the drawing each week. Switch to Rite Aid and fill up on all the rewards we have to offer. See circular for coupon and pharmacists for details. Not valid in New York or New Jersey.
A crash can happen in an instant. Getting help should be no different. Within seconds, an OnStar advisor can automatically connect into your vehicle.
This is OnStar. I got a signal you've been in a crash.
Automatic crash response is standard for the first year on Chevy Malibu, not Camry or Accord. Yes, they'll have to wait for help. And wait. And wait. Visit OnStar.com for details and system limitations. OnStar acts as a link to existing emergency service providers.
As a busy executive, it wasn't until I started flying nonstop on ExpressJet Airlines that I found the time to take a stroll around the old workspace and appreciate the wonders that are the modern office. I mean, take this fax machine, for example. Totally awesome! Or this paper shredder. What's this? An electric stapler? Boy, what will they think of next? You know, if it weren't for the time I save with ExpressJet Airlines, I wouldn't be able to enjoy all this cool stuff. Ooh, what's this?
Welcome to an airline that measures travel satisfaction and the time it saves you. Because we know there are things you'd rather be doing than flying.
Hey, Steve, what am I cutting here anyway?
I believe that's payroll, sir.
This is fantastic! Look, Steve, I'm making salary cuts! Get it?
Not really.
Non-stop flights on ExpressJet Airlines. What are you waiting for?
Fly ExpressJet Airlines non-stop from Fresno to L.A., Ontario, Long Beach, and San Diego while enjoying free XM radio. Go to ExpressJet.com to book your flight today.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming to you from Omaha, Nebraska this week. The Bulldogs are in the College World Series, and just like they are all over the valley, there are plenty of World War II veterans here in the heartland, and one of them is Sam Basile, who served in the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II, a waist gunner on a B-17. You heard him describe how he was shot down over Germany in October of 1944. You heard him describe that long drop down to the earth, ending up in a German village and captured by Germans once he hit the ground. Now, once they got a hold of you, what did they do with you? And maybe more importantly, what was going through your mind? Did you think that, I mean, obviously you had no idea how much longer the war was going to last. It seems like a pretty uncertain future to me.
Well, you know, they were, at one time we used to carry a 45, and towards the end of our tour, they told us that, you know, that they didn't think the war was going to last much longer, that we were on the winning side, and that it'd be smart to leave your 45 at home in case, you know, you did get shot down. You wouldn't, with the 45, they're more apt to shoot you than without. And it just, you know, we didn't carry it anymore. And of course then, you know, of course, as far as I was concerned, we all thought the, you know, they even were, "We'll Be Home for Christmas," that song they were singing and all that stuff, but it just didn't work out that way, you know.
Instead, you'd have a very cold Christmas as a guest of the Gestapo. Where, how long was it before they started moving you?
They took us to, from that little village, they took us to an air base there outside of Berlin, and they kept us there a couple of days. I don't know, maybe 3 days. I'm not sure, but we stayed there, had us in separate rooms. There's no bed, just a hard bench. And then finally, I think the reason for keeping us there, being that we bombed Berlin, they took us into Berlin. I guess they'd mob us and maybe have a hanging or something. And so they kept us away for a few days, and then they brought us into Berlin at the main train station. And they had, I think they had more Air Force guards around us than there was us. But I know they had us backed up against the wall in the station waiting for the train, and the people come by and just look at us, spit at us, and everything else, you know, giving us just some terrible looks. And then when we got on the train, they moved some people out of a compartment. Oh, boy, did the sparks fly. And they put us all in this compartment, and we sat down right next to him, you know, one between us. And in fact, there was a young kid, you know, he kept trying to find out. He couldn't speak English, but he'd, you know, make signs like I was shooting a machine gun and I was flying, you know, and I kept saying nix to him. He was just probably about, I think he could have been even younger than I was, you know, and I was only 19. So, but anyway, they really treat us well. Those Air Force people, the Air Force had respect for us. The German Air Force,
the Luftwaffe, yeah.
Yeah, the Luftwaffe. They had respect for us. And from there we went to a staging center, you know, where they took, I think it was either Munich or Frankfurt, one or the other. And that's where they put us in. They interrogated us there.
I think that the notorious one was there in Frankfurt, the Dulag Luft, where they interrogated everyone. And did you find that they knew more about you than you knew about yourself?
Every time, sometimes I'd go somewhere and somebody would talk to me in Italian, and I'd say, Nix for Stain, no matter what they said, you know. And then, of course, you know, they threw you in the dungeon, and you'd stay in the dungeon overnight, and then they'd bring you up the next day, and you'd go in this guy and ask, he'd had a form there he wanted you to fill, and I'd, of course, my name, rank, and serial number, and they give you that blow. Anyway, I got a job to do just like you do, you know. I want you to fill this paper. Where'd you come from? Who were you with? Where'd you live? All that kind of question they ask you. And every time I just didn't say nothing, back down the dungeon. In fact, one time they put somebody else down there with me. And we were told that they try that. Mm-hmm. And then you start a conversation with him. Evidently, he must have been an American because he didn't say anything and I didn't say anything. And so, and then back down, up again, down again, up again. So I went up there, and he had that form. I just took a big pencil, put an X on it, and he smacked me, knocked me off my chair. Some old guy. Anyway, Then the guard come in and took me, put me in the dungeon, and that was the end of interrogation. Then they took me, I think, to Munich then afterwards, where they were, I think, the American commander of that camp was an Air Force pilot by the name Colonel Kabreski. Mm-hmm. He was an air ace.
He was, a very famous one, yeah.
Yes, he was. And the first thing, he had us all together, and he says, there's one thing I want you to do. Don't eat too much of the bread that they're giving you. You'll catch pneumonia. And I couldn't figure out, what the heck's he talking? Don't eat the bread. I was hungry. I mean, don't eat the bread. It's just, it'll make you gassy. You'll blow your covers off. I don't know if they want to print this.
Well, our listeners just heard it. And, of course, that bread famously was made more of sawdust than anything else. Tree flour.
I think, it was hard as a rock. You know, I think they piled it outside. I think waterproof and everything. You know,
could have built a pretty good house with it, huh?
And they said to make sure when you eat it, cut it thin, because I think it was made by prisoners. So there could be anything in it, glass or whatever.
I've heard people tell that story, too. Yeah. So you end up in Poland at Stalag Luft 4?
Yes. They put us on a train. They took to Stalag Luft 4. And I met at our barracks there. There was about 20, 22, somewhere in a room, about 12 or 12. And there was three of them were Polish. They got out of Poland. They went to Ireland, England, joined the RAF, you know. Mm. One of them was Staju, one was Stasiu. The other one, he was an older one, and he was a nice guy, but he wasn't as friendly as the other two. You know, he used to always say, you know, always kind of lecture me to be good, do this, you know, kind of, because I think I was pretty wild and stuff like that, and but the other two, we were good friends, you know, with them. They were real nice guys, and they with the RAF, and when the German guards, we had guys stationed at both ends of the barracks. There must have been about, I don't know how many, 200 or 300 in a barrack, you know. Whenever a German would come up, they'd holler goons up. So sometimes we'd go up through the attic and we'd take every other rafter to burn to keep warm, you know.
Right.
So we wanted to make sure that none of the German guards were in them. We were ripping the wood out of the attic. And there's one German that come in. He was an older one. And these Polish guys would get on him and say, Deutschland kaputt. Then everybody hide. He'd take his gun out and swing it, you know. Deutschland not kaputt, you know. Deutschland forever, you know. They would always shake him up, you know. He'd pull his gun out and wave it. And they did it every time to him. But, I think sometime they locked us up. They let us out at 8 in the morning. Then they locked us up at 4 in the afternoon, closed the shutters.
And you talked about having to burn any wood you can find to stay warm. Obviously, the food was very sparse. But how brutal was that winter? Had you ever felt cold like that before?
No, I didn't get cold. But the food, I don't know if I should tell you this. They'll cut it out if they don't think they should.
Well, I imagine you're going to tell me about some of the disgusting things you ate.
Yeah.
Feel free.
Okay, anyway, the first night I was there, they brought some soup. I think it was grass soup or seaweed soup. And they brought it out, and I looked, and then there was some white things. You know, and I had this Englishman. I says, what's those white things? He says, those are maggots from the horse meat. Maggots? I didn't eat it. I bet it was a week or maybe two before I got hungry enough, and I was hungry before I ate it. And I find the Englishman says, take your spoon, push it down, and if you look, all the maggots go on the bottom, then come back and then eat. And that's what I did. And I ate it. Then every time it came, I ate without any problem.
Yeah, when you're in a desperate situation, you do things you wouldn't do any other time. How much weight did you lose as a POW?
I was about, you know, when I went down, I was pretty heavy. I think I was about like I am now, about 175 pounds. And I went down to a 26 waist. I probably weighed, maybe 120, 125 pounds.
Yeah, that kind of puts it in perspective for us. I want to get to Liberation Day in our next segment and talk about what you've done more recently with the Honor Flight Network and all of that. But anything else from your time as a POW that maybe really stands out in your memory, maybe something that you saw or experienced with your friends there that really sticks with you as something special?
Well, I made a friend. He was a Scotsman. He taught me how to play bridge. And I mean, I really got to liking him. He was a real, real nice guy, and his name was Josh. And you just couldn't meet a nicer friend than he was, really. And we played cards. He says, "We're going to win the tournament." Well, the first game we got beat something terrible. Them Canadians were really good. Yeah, but anyway, why? And another thing that happened that I didn't like, the ball turret gunner was in the, I think I was in D and he was in C, the barbed wire between us. And every once in a while, he'd come by when I was coming by, and I'd talk to him. This German, I don't know, he'd come out of the ground or somewhere. He'd always come out and kick me in the butt every time, you know. Hmm. For me, you're not supposed to talk across the wire, you know.
Right.
Oh, God, I just couldn't figure where he came from because I watched for him. I knew he was laying for me. He must have come up out of the ground. But other than that, why?
You mentioned your friend, Josh. I imagine in a situation like that where you have no idea how long you're going to be there, if you're going to survive or not, having a friend like that probably made all the difference in the world.
He was a good friend, really. Real good friend. He was older than I was, but and he was a good bridge player, but I was brand new at it. It's kind of a tough game.
Well, we're going to talk about more than just games, the rest of Sam's experience as a prisoner of war in Europe, when he was liberated, what that felt like, and what he's been up to in just the last few weeks that I hope a lot of other veterans in our valley and around the country can experience. We're going to be right back with more Hometown Heroes from Omaha on News Talk 580 KMJ.
I looked at her, and I was just, wow, she looks so young.
I told her I couldn't believe how smooth her face looks. She's lost, 10 years, at least?
I look at her, and it's like I'm looking at a picture of my wife from 20 years ago. It's incredible.
How are ordinary women across America looking years younger? They've discovered the proven breakthrough called Hydroxytone. It erases wrinkles, tightens skin, and makes frown lines disappear from view. See for yourself by requesting a free trial of Hydroxytone today. The results are so impressive. Hydroxytone was given away in the VIP gift bags at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Try Hydroxytone risk-free and shed years from your appearance faster than you thought possible.
She always looked good to me, but now I can't believe how young she looks.
Call now for your free trial of Hydroxytone. For a limited time, try it before you buy it. 1-800-482-9611. But hurry, when this offer's gone, it's gone. Call 1-800-482-9611. 1-800-482-9611.
You wanted it? Okay, you win. 0% financing for 72 months on virtually every new GM model at the Keller store.
See dealer for exclusions.
Yes, and that rate's good right now through Monday, June 30th only. Do not tarry. See Keller about 0% for 72 months and the rebates up to $7,000 on Tahoe, Suburbans, and Yukon XL.
A Keller deal.
Indeed it is. And all at Keller Motors, the largest all-in-one GM dealer on the West Coast on 198 and 11th and 3rd.
Kelly Shields is a real Californian providing real hope.
A few years ago, things were good. You know, living the American dream. But this year wasn't going as well. Turns out we had an adjustable rate loan. All of a sudden, I thought we'd lose everything. We qualified for help and got to keep our home. It could work for you, too.
If you find yourself in a situation like Kelly, there's hope. Call 888-995-HOPE or visit yourhome.ca.gov to learn more. This message is brought to you by the State of California, aired by the California Broadcasters.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Remember, if you have a World War II veteran in your life that you think ought to be featured on this program, you can email me, paul@kmj580.com. Just have about 6 minutes left with Sam Sambasili. The time has gone way too fast, as it always does. Sam is an Omaha veteran of World War II. You've heard him talk about his time in the Army Air Corps, being shot down on his 33rd mission, a prisoner of war at Stalag Luft 4 in Poland. And you actually had to experience another POW camp before the war was over. Tell me how that transpired.
Well, the Russians were coming towards our camp in Poland, and they loaded us in boxcars and shipped us to, some of us went to Bart Jeremy Stalaglif 1, and others were on that death march. I was fortunate to go to Stalaglif 1 in Bart Germany, and I was put in a camp there with, that was basically, I think originally it was an officer's camp, and so I was there with, I know my officer Jess Brashers was there, and but I didn't see any other of my crew members, and I spent the rest of my time there till in May when the Russians came and liberated us, and they were unhappy because we didn't show enough enthusiasm. They want us to tear everything down, barracks and all. But our officer says, no, we'll tear the barbed wire down. We've got to have a place to stay. We're going to keep the barracks, and maybe later on somebody else can use them. So we tore 20,000 guys out tearing barbed wire down all at one time, made the Russians happy.
News Talk 580 KMJ Fresno. You're listening to Russia's Week in Review on the EIB Network.
All right, now try this. You think I'm wrong about these little clods on the left and their desire for control. This is from the Madison, Wisconsin Capital Times, and it is a, I don't know if it's a column story, but the writer is named Mike Ivey. And the headline here says it all, should Madison, Wisconsin ban the restaurant drive-thru? First, it was a proposed ban on plastic bags. Now, a member of the influential Madison Plan Commission wants to ban the restaurant drive-thru or at least restrict the ubiquitous symbol of America's autocentric lifestyle. Eric Sundquist, who was appointed to the citizen panel by Mayor Dave whatever, said, given the concern about all the carbon going into the atmosphere, I'm not sure we should be building more places for people to sit idling their cars. A former newspaper reporter in Atlanta, now working as a researcher at the UW-Madison's Center on Wisconsin Strategy, Eric Sundquist, notes that several cities in Canada have recently moved to ban the drive-through coffee shop or standalone fast food restaurant. Bans haven't gotten as far in the U.S., although I know San Luis Obispo, California, has one. The issue came up last week during discussions over a conditional use permit for a new Starbucks along a congested frontage road across from the Easttown Mall. They're going to ban drive-thrus because they think What was the other ridiculous thing that we happened last week? We were going to ban something because of the carbon footprint on global warming. It was just absurd. This is no different. Idling. Idling at a drive-thru. I know. He's appointed this. I know that, Snurdly. Point is, it's never going to end until people just stand up and say, enough, stop it. Do you see what this hoax, do you see the latitude this is giving these people to restrict your freedom? Virtually everything involving your freedom, your automobile, your ability to move around, go where you want, when you want, is under assault. On the basis that you doing so are destroying the planet. Tony in Palm Harbor, Florida. I'm glad you waited. Welcome to the EIB network.
Rush, how you doing, man?
Fine, sir.
I just wanted to ask you, please, to back off on John McCain a little bit, simply because the judicial system is at stake. We can't afford Barack Obama and his Marxist friends appointing judges to the Supreme Court. It will be a Marxist judicial tyranny, a Marxist dictatorship from the bench, man. They'll overturn the results of elections. They won't respect freedom of speech, private property, and freedom of religion. So just back off on John McCain a little bit, man. He's got a 22-year run of being solid pro-life. Do like Herman Edwards, the head coach of the KC Chiefs, said, play to win the game, Rush. Let's play to win the game. Get him elected. Get rid of this Obama.
Wait a minute. Wait just a second. In the first thing, the court doesn't respect a whole lot of those things you mentioned a moment ago anyway. Probably.
We don't need any more of it.
I understand that. But you're going to cite Herman Edwards?
I'm just asking to play the game to win.
You're going
to,
yeah.
We can win this thing, Rush. And after the election, you can say what you want about him. But right now, let's win this thing.
Wait a minute. What have I been doing the past couple? How have you said I'm not? How am I hurting McCain?
Rush, you come up, you make fun of McCain with that growl like he's insane when you mimic him and joke about him. We can't go in a tank with Coulter, Barr, and Dobson and hand the judicial system over to this clown. There's too much at stake here. After the election, say what you want to say.
You haven't been listening closely enough.
I've been listening very closely.
Well, you haven't heard me say then that we can't afford Obama.
I know that.
Well,
I'm asking, I understand that, but what I'm basically asking you to say underlying that is please back off on John McCain.
Okay, all right.
That's all I'm asking you to do.
When the guy stands up and starts talking, a green government starts going...
I agree with you
Jimmy,
on all that.
Jimmy Carter, too.
Rush, I agree
says,
with all that.
I'm experienced crossing the aisle working with Democrats.
Rush,
what
hold on, man.
Go, yay!
Rush, I agree with all that.
Well,
but
then...
But do it after he gets, God willing, elected. We can't afford this guy economically, and we can't afford him judicially.
Don't you understand what's happening here?
I know that global warming is a crock of crap, but right now the judicial system is the most important thing we've got.
Don't you think I know that?
We can't afford another pro-abortion judge, man.
Don't you think I know that?
Play to win the game, Rush. That's all I'm asking.
What do you
baby.
Think I'm all about?
That's
what you,
it.
Wait a minute.
Just get on the team and play the game
what do you
to
think
win
Operation...
and get rid of this sucker, man.
Tony, calm down just a second. What do you think the purpose of Operation Chaos was?
It was brilliant. I loved Operation Chaos.
Yeah, but did
Chaos.
You... So we win was the bottom line. So we win to create chaos in the Democrat Party. Do you know what's going on here?
Go ahead,
with me,
it.
With me. Do you know what I'm actually trying to do here?
All I hear you do is knock John McCain with that mimicking his voice like he's some kind of an insane character who just got out of the nut house.
Well,
this is the big one. Rush on the EIB network.
Can you believe it's been 5 years?
5 years of fun.
5 years of winning.
5 years of Cherchansey Gold Resort and Casino.
So how do you celebrate a fifth anniversary this big?
I don't know.
How about by giving away the biggest prize ever? $1 million.
You heard it right. During the entire month of June, it's your chance at $1 million with Cherchansey's Million Dollar Main Event.
Just use your rewards card and earn tickets for the $1 million drawing on July 5th. Plus, every Saturday in June, it's your chance at a share of $140,000.
And all month long, dancing, karaoke, slot tournaments, and amazing concerts like Smokey Robinson.
This is the big one. $1 million.
Come celebrate 5 great years of
fun at Tecumseh the entire month of June.
And you could walk away with $1 million.
Tecumseh, number one for so many reasons.
On Highway 41, just north of Fresno. Less than 21 or older to gain. Call 1-866-7-WIN-WIN for details.
This is the 50,000-watt information, weather, and traffic leader. Broadcasting's News Talk 580. KMJ Fresno.
The news starts now.